Another Mystery Crate, and this is a passion project. We always say that this is a self-indulgent podcast for the diehards of the Dan Le Batard Show with Stu Gatz. We talk about our passions on this podcast, and I'm joined by Anthony Kalatayude, known as Tony, by basically just Dan. It's weird. But Anthony is a fan of one of the greatest arcade games of all time, as am I, NBA Jam. And our audience will be thrilled to know that our guest, Rayon Ali, wrote a book about NBA Jam, the greatest arcade game arguably ever. Many could say, is it even the greatest Midway arcade game? Midway certainly had this slot of real estate to themselves. Basically, there's party lines here, Rayon. It's either NFL Blitz or NBA Jam. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But Rayon, first and foremost, obviously, NBA Jam makes everybody of a certain age light up. I imagine it's the same with you because you spent many years working on this book. So what compelled you to write a book about the greatest arcade game arguably ever?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm a huge NBA Jam fan. So yeah, so going back to 2015, when I really wanted to write a book, I had pitched a couple of music books that didn't work out. And I really wanted to sink my teeth into something substantial. So I thought, like, what is something out there that I could do that would be really valuable, something that I could actually take in the nonfiction space and make it my own? So I found this publisher called Boss Fight Books out of Los Angeles, and their whole idea is that they do individual books about individual video games. So they'll do one book about Super Mario Brothers 2 by one author, one book about Super Mario Brothers 3 by a separate author, one book about Galaga by a third author, and so forth. So different authors and different books. So back in 2015, when I was writing, they had this open call for pitches, and they said, yeah, pitch us a book, we'll see. And then I was like, man, I really, really want to do something. I'm like, wow, I would love to write a book, but what is a video game that's really worth writing a book about? What's something that I have a connection to? What's something that I think would really impress people? What would really get people talking? And I thought about it, and I was like, oh, obviously NBA Jam, it's right there. So yeah, I'm a huge NBA Jam fan myself. So I've had kind of an interesting trajectory with it. I was born in Texas, but I grew up in Pakistan. So when I was probably about, let's say, 9 or 10, I first saw NBA Jam on the back of a comic book, a Superboy comic book, and I loved it. The colors really stood out to me. And then from there, I got so big into NBA Jam that I got big into the NBA. So I'm probably one of those interesting cases out there where, like, somebody who got an NBA Jam and then the NBA, not vice versa. But yeah, what's funny is my very first ever writing gig, going long back before the music writing stuff, was for a Mortal Kombat website when I was probably 12 or 13. So when that opportunity came to pitch Boss Fight Books about this NBA Jam book, I was like, I already know a lot of these people, just their names themselves. As a kid, I was geeking out, looking at developers' names over there and learning about secret characters. So it was really a very easy fit for me, and I was super excited to get started on the project because as a fan, I was like, I want to know as much as there is to know about NBA Jam.
You could probably put a quantifiable metric to this. I'm sure you did as a part of your research. Just going into this flying blind, is NBA Jam the biggest arcade game of the 1990s?
Ooh, you know what's funny is that it is really close, but it is not the biggest arcade game of the 1990s because what Midway was just on such a hot streak in the early 90s. They released Mortal Kombat, which was huge, broke records for the company. And then NBA Jam came out a year later. And then later that year in 1993, Mortal Kombat 2 came out. So Mortal Kombat 2 actually topped NBA Jam in terms of earnings, but it was pretty close. And NBA Jam by far had its own niche, its own separate area where it was the first NBA arcade game. And of course, you know, NBA Jam made $1 billion, which is just staggering. But yeah, I mean, Midway was on such a hot streak and NBA Jam really started a whole new era. NBA Jam was special not because of just NBA Jam success, but because of the games that came afterward. I mean, you had NBA Jam Tournament Edition, NBA Hang Time, NBA Showtime, NFL Blitz, NHL Open Ice, MLB Slugfest, NHL Hits. I mean, you can keep going and going. And those are just the Midway games, not even counting other stuff that other companies did. Or, you know, EA did with the NFL Street, NBA Street series. I mean, all that stuff was born from that.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because NBA Jam, were these true sequels or just are they all under that original game's umbrella? Because I remember NBA JMTE Tournament Edition, the He's on Fire Edition, they were all like slightly different versions of the same game. There weren't very many updates to it. So does it all count for just the NBA Jam brand? I don't think that there was like an NBA Jam 95, 96, 97.
Yeah. So the main NBA Jam brand, the classic NBA Jam that people think of, is NBA Jam and NBA Jam Tournament Edition, which is what this book is really about. But then I do get into some of the other games that were out there, and they're not necessarily within the main NBA Jam umbrella because of some really interesting things that happened. So Midway released the arcade game, made $1 billion. Then Acclaim comes along, and they've got a contract with Midway to have the first look option for their games to put them in the home market. So then Acclaim releases NBA Jam for Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis, makes, I think they sell 6 million copies just from Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis, first run of NBA Jam. That's not counting Game Boy, Game Gear, NBA Jam Tournament Edition, nothing to do with the arcade games, just Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis.
Wow, it's a monster.
It's a monster right out the gate. And then some really interesting stuff happens in 1995 with the negotiating of the license. So both Midway and Acclaim have some sort of right to it, but some things got shuttled around over there. And then Acclaim actually ended up with the NBA Jam license. So they released NBA Jam Extreme with Marv Albert on commentary, which wasn't very good. And then some late 90s NBA Jams, which nobody remembers. I mean, I always forget about it. NBA Jam 2000 with Keith Van Horn.
Keith Van Horn. That's there was a console.
Exactly, exactly. And I always forget that this thing exists. Yeah, I wrote the book about it, and I forget this thing exists all the time. But there are some of these NBA Jam games out there by Acclaim, but they're not part of the main lineage. So the Midway developers that made the first game, they then went on to make NBA Hang Time, NBA Showtime, NFL Blitz. So that's kind of, it's interesting. It's kind of two separate lineages that both have Acclaim to NBA Jam, one in name and the other one in spirit. So it's kind of all part of the big overarching umbrella. And I try to get into at least all of them.
So, guys, the funny thing is, you guys know it as the arcade game where you guys would go in and play. I'm from a different generation, the generation that grew up. I was born in 91. So, for me, I was introduced to NBA Jams maybe in like 98, 99, 2000. So, I'm part of that weird, like, what are we really doing here with all these NBA Jams, Showtime, Hang Time? And I remember playing on my N64 and that being like the end-all, be-all of what the gaming console was at that time. Like, When you started playing, what was your console of choice when you started playing NBA Jams? And then when it evolved, like, where did you take it? Did you go to all these different kind of spin-off games, or did you stay true to the one before?
Definitely. So, yeah, so I started off with the Sega Genesis version of NBA Jam Tournament Edition, same one that I saw on the back of that Superboy comic book that I love so much. What's funny is, yeah, growing up in Pakistan, we used the European system, so it'd actually be the Sega Mega Drive 2. Same system, different name. But yeah, I followed NBA Jam around for a long while. I mean, I loved NBA Jam as a kid. So, you know, I knew about NBA Hang Time that came out in arcades, but I didn't have access to it. So I know it was on Genesis. And then, yeah, I definitely played NBA Showtime on the PlayStation and Dreamcast. And of course, there's those arcade versions. I definitely kept up with the series. But the thing is that there was so much that happened in that time in terms of how they changed. Like, they changed the mechanics of the series. It went from 2-on-2 to 3-on-3 for one instance for NBA Hoops. Then there was 5-on-5 with NBA Jam by Acclaim. So I kept up with the series. But, you know, for me, like the true spirit of NBA Jam is always going to be those original two, NBA Jam and NBA Jam Tournament Edition.
All right, let's get into some of the geekier decisions made about this game that ended up making it iconic. You mentioned, I remember picking up comic books and seeing that pop art sort of pop out and catch me right away, as it's designed to do. The aesthetic of the game, and then the narration of the game, which in just perusing the book, it seemed to be a bit rushed, and they didn't really know that it would turn out to be this iconic thing with the whole boom shakalaka. So from an aesthetic standpoint, not a game design standpoint, how much thought went into catching people of our age, and did they know what they were doing when they had this crazy commentary?
What's crazy is that iconic NBA Jam announcer, you know, the guy who does boom shakalaka, he's on fire, all these amazing calls, wasn't actually the original guy. The original guy was the sound guy on the team, John Hay, who, funny enough, was also the voice of Raiden in Mortal Kombat 1.
Really?
So you ever played the original Mortal Kombat? Yeah, and you hear Raiden screaming or something like that. That's actually the sound guy from NBA Jam, so the guy who did the NBA Jam theme, the music and whatnot. So he was who Mark Turmel, who is the lead designer on the NBA Jam team, pitched as being the voice of the game for that part of it. But John Hay was like, I don't think I'm the right person for it. I know somebody else. So John Hay knew this drummer in this band, the Lazy Boy Rockers, and his name was Tim Kitzrow. So yeah, so Kitzrow came into Midway just to do voices for pinball games, essentially do imitations of famous people. And then Midway starts working on NBA Jam. Mark Trammell says to John Hay, hey, we should get somebody to do this. You know, maybe you could do it. And then John Hay says, actually, Tim Kitzer would be the man. So Tim Kitzer comes on in, and he, you know, he was really excited to do it, but he didn't necessarily know how big this was going to be. So in some ways, it was very impromptu. Like, he comes in, he gets paid something like $50 an hour, great gig for him. Super excited, big NBA fan. You know, he gets to do all of his calls. He's trying to really ramp up the energy and kind of do a Marv Albert impression without going straight Marv Albert on everything. What was crazy is that, you know, he does all this. He has no idea how big it's going to be. And like I said, he got paid $50 per hour, which is a really good deal back in, you know, 92 for a gig like that. And then the game makes $1 billion. So for that original NBA Jam, that iconic game, it made $1 billion, and the announcer got something like 1,000 to 1,500 overall for it.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. And Tim Kitzer is kind of like the tragicomic character of the book. Like somebody who, like, you know, you can see this passion, enthusiasm, but you also see he gets, he does not get a fair shake time and time again.
It became such a huge part of the marketing strategy eventually. And the marketing strategy was, I mean, as you mentioned in the comic books, it was ideal to catch people with us. It was eye-popping. I don't know how much you get into the marketing of the arcade game and then the console games in the book, but once they realized they had a hit, did they then put the marketing dollars behind this? Was this more of a word-of-mouth thing and then they put resources behind it? Or did they know what they had here in this game and decided to push it to the target demo?
So the team at Midway knew that they had a really good game. But with arcade games, even for a really good game, you're not 100% sure until you're sure. And then what happened was, sometime in late 1992, they went to a place to, or they went to Dennis's Place for Games in Chicago, which is this arcade where they would take games on test. So they would put a game in the corner or put a game someplace and then basically use the audience that was there playing the game as a test audience to say, okay, you know, how's it, how are they responding to it? You know, are people coming up to play it and whatnot? And immediately NBA Jam was a hit. So it was a huge hit. And people were, you know, lining up, and they knew that people were really into it. But it was still just an arcade game at that point in late 1992. So the real turning point for NBA Jam, the arcade game, came in 1993 at the NBA All-Star Weekend in Salt Lake City. The NBA had a whole bunch of cabinets shipped out over there. So imagine a room at NBA All-Star Weekend somewhere in a convention center in Salt Lake City where you've got something like 20, 30 NBA Jam machines all lined up together. And these are all brand new. You know, you've got NBA fans from around the country, probably from around the world, that have never played NBA Jam before and even heard of this game. And they're all playing it for the first time. So that was when Midway really knew that the game had taken off. And that's when the NBA really knew how big it was.
I think one of the integral parts of the success of NBA Jams was in its infant stage was the 2-on-2, right? Like, how did they see that and say, you know what, 2-on-2 is what we're going to make it. We're not going to try to make it 5-on-5. We're not going to try to convolute the entire screen with people where you're going to have to, you know, make choices on who you want to be. 2-on-2, is that a little bit of the success of NBA Jam?
Definitely, definitely. It was 2-on-2 is a big part of the success for NBA Jam for a few different reasons. Well, what's weird is that for like 5 minutes back in 1992, when they're first coming up with the idea for the game, they actually wanted to make it 1-on-1, which is very strange. Like, the idea of NBA Jam 1-on-1 would be a completely different game. Yeah, this is one of those things that I imagine they talked about, but they didn't really do anything with, you know, just besides just spitballing. But yeah, 2-on-2 was absolutely crucial to it when they decided that they're going to go with it. There was another game out at the time called Arch Rivals, which is this old arcade basketball game. It's unlicensed, but it's a fun game. It's kind of clunky. It's kind of on the older side, but it's still a fun game. But it was 2-on-2. And what's funny is that Midway came out with it before NBA Jam. And somebody who was one of the execs over at Williams Bally Midway, the company that released Arch Rivals, saw the success of Arch Rivals, which was 2-on-2, but with two controller panels. And they saw that and they said, well, how about we make it 4 controller panels? So, you know, everybody's got their own player. Still 2-on-2, but now you've got 4 players instead of 2. Midway knew that, you know, 2-on-2 basketball was a real good avenue for them. That's something that they could really do something with. And then Mark Trammell capitalized on this, and he saw how big this was going to be. And then that 2-on-2 ended up being so important to the earnings of NBA Jam, because you don't get to $1 billion just easily. You get to $1 billion as an arcade game through, you know, moving pieces around in a few interesting ways. So NBA Jam was making something like, you know, let's say $8 and about let's say 8 to 10 minutes. So it's racking up the money, racking up the money. That was really where the 2-on-2 really paid off, because you had 1-on-1, you'd immediately cut that number in half. And without the 2-on-2 aspect, with 4 people playing, you don't have that same kind of energy. You don't have people yelling in the same way and that same kind of excitement. I mean, that people would still love it, but not to the same degree. So that 2-on-2 was absolutely crucial.
I want to jump on that 2-on-2 thing, because this was a controversial thing in league circles. Who made the 2-on-2? Who decided who the two representatives were from each team? And then we'll ask, there's certain high-profile individuals that my friend Anthony will ask about that weren't featured in the top two that probably should have.
Yeah. So what's funny is that, you know, nowadays, if you made an NBA game, you've got to go through so much red tape. There's so many things you got to do. You know, you need to vet this, vet that. Of course, you've got access to the internet if you want to go see who the best players are on a team. But back in 1992, when they're working on NBA Jam, there was only a team of 7 people that developed the game, which still is staggering to me. 7 people. So you had other people that were doing things like hardware, like checking on hardware or audio or in marketing or, you know, on the executive level, but really fundamentally 7 people. And out of that 7 people, I think there were 3 basketball fans. And those 3 basketball fans, or maybe 2 of those 3 basketball fans, picked those teams. So at the time, you know, if you got some real weird picks in NBA Jam. You've got Brad Lowhouse and Blue Edwards on the Milwaukee Bucks, which is like, you know, why did these guys necessarily end up in NBA Jam? Or, you know, why is Mike Isolino on the Mavericks? Well, it's because that week they were doing really well. Or around that time, they were doing really well. And Mark Trammell and John Hay said, okay, we need some players from the Bucks or from the Mavs or whomever, so let's go with these guys. So they were on a hot streak at some point in 1982, and they just got picked because of that. So Trammell and John Hay submitted it to the NBA, and the NBA did some back and forth with them. But they were essentially the ones who picked it. So a couple of developers at Midway who didn't even have access to like real deal stats, as far as I know, they pretty much just went through newspapers, watched TV, try to figure out who's really having a moment right now, and then bring them into the game. So it's crazy, pretty impromptu for something that's so iconic. You know, we remember those faces so well. There's just a couple of guys that are just like, okay, let's go with these guys. That's our pick for the Wizards or whomever.
The real question is this: where's Michael Jordan? Was it a branding issue? Was it just the gamers didn't know about him if they weren't NBA fans? Like where is this missing piece?
Yeah, Michael Jordan was left out all because of licensing. So Michael Jordan's licensing agreement was separate from the rest of the NBA's, even of course in early 92, because at that point, you know, Jordan has yet to hit that second three-peat, but of course Jordan is Jordan. You can tell where things are going. So he'd already separated himself from the pack. So his licensing agreement was separate from the license agreement for all the other players. But there's an amazing story is that somebody on Michael Jordan's team, I'm not sure if it was Michael Jordan himself that somehow got word of it, but somebody on his team found out about NBA Jam and how big it was and how hot it was. And even though NBA Jam came out without Michael Jordan on the Bulls, instead it was Scottie Pippen and Horace Grant, somebody from Michael Jordan's team contacted Midway and said, hey, we would love a special version of the game with Michael Jordan in it. And keep in mind, the Midway team that made NBA Jam, that made Mortal Kombat, all these guys are from Chicago. So Michael Jordan saying, hey, we want a special version of NBA Jam with Michael Jordan in it in 1982. I mean, that's peak. Like, that's like, wow, of course we're going to do it. So yeah, so they made a special version of the game and they sent it out on over to him. So he had a special limited edition arcade cabinet. And what's weird is that it wasn't just Michael Jordan. It was also Gary Payton, who was in NBA Jam Tournament Edition very famously with Sean Kemp on the Supersonics. But if you go back to that very first NBA Jam, he's not actually in there, which is weird. I think everybody remembers that classic Sonics team and thinks that he's in NBA Jam 1, but he's actually in what's basically NBA Jam 2. So yeah, so it was Gary Payton in this edition with Michael Jordan. And then the third one was Ken Griffey Jr., which is just another mind trip. So Ken Griffey Jr. knew Gary Payton and knew Michael Jordan, and they were all part of the same kind of circle, and they all asked Midway to put them in the game, and Midway did it. So there's a special limited edition version of NBA Jam out there. Very, very, very rare. So rare that I worked on this for 4 years and have yet to see any video footage or photos of it, but as far as I know, it's real. There's a version out there that has Michael Jordan, Gary Payton, and Ken Griffey Jr. in it. And it's just crazy to think that something like this exists. And just to add to this whole crazy mythology is that Gary Payton, of course, he got a couple of arcade games back in the day. So he still has them. So in his place in California right now, as we speak, there's an NBA Jam version with these 3 people in it But Gary has yet to show it to anybody. But as far as I know, it's out there. So that just blows my mind that after all these years, there's still an NBA Jam secret we haven't totally seen.
You wrote NBA Jam, the book, and you were trying to get all the information about this secret copy, I imagine. So how hard did you push Gary Payton and his camp to get access to this mythical machine?
You know, I was thinking, like, so as far as I knew, it was Mark Tremell, the lead designer of the game, Gary Payton, Ken Griffey Jr., and Michael Jordan, who had copies. So I didn't have any kind of, I couldn't find any kind of link to Michael Jordan to reasonably ask, or Ken Griffey Jr. But with Gary Payton, I found his management, and they're like, oh yeah, this is cool. Let's get in touch with Gary. So yeah, she was really cool. But then she said that she was going to check on it, but then never checked on it. And then I kept like poking her, like, hey, is there any chance that Gary can just even take a picture, just acknowledge his existence, like prove something for the rest of us out there that are going to geek out over this. So I definitely pushed, but unfortunately no go from Gary's people yet, but I'm really optimistic about it. I think in our lifetimes, we're going to see this amazing version at some point.
Rayon, yeah. This seems to be a bit of a holy grail. I think this has like a really high street value. Tremell needs to realize that if he just puts this thing out there or decides he even finish it and give it the traditional arcade setup, that thing could be hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not close to a million.
Easily. And I mean, the fan reaction itself would just be incredible. There was a story that was just in the news recently about how Mark Tremell rigged the code so that the Pistons would always beat the Bulls.
You're opening the door to some of the mythology here. We got into the secret copy. So yes. All right, audience, let's do this a little bit rapid fire because we're running out of time here and there's so many urban legends in regards to this game. I always heard that the Bulls were programmed to choke at the end of games and that the Pistons, that whoever created the game was a Piston fan and he made it so that the Pistons would win almost every time.
Mark Tremell was a diehard Pistons fan, and yes, that is true. Yeah, so he did rig it that way. So yeah, it's incredible that he did that. But yes, he did that. That's amazing. I love that fanboy aspect of him. Such a diehard Pistons fan that he beat the Bulls, man. So yes, that is true.
So, but were the Bulls programmed to choke, or it was just because whenever they played the Pistons, they were programmed to lose because the Pistons were
So it all came down to that classic Bulls and Pistons rivalry from the late 80s. So Mark Tremell, who worked at Midway, was one of, like, he came over to Chicago, but he was actually from Michigan, and he loved the Pistons. So in the late 80s, when the Pistons were beating the Bulls, Tremell was working in Chicago and would love to brag. You know, he would go around the hallways and he would chant "Bad Boys" at the other Bulls fans in the office. And he was the only Pistons fan. But then, of course, you know, things changed. And by the early 90s, now the Pistons are on their way out and the Bulls are on their way up. So Mark Tremell was such a big Pistons fan. He was like, man, I really want my team to win. This is my team. So he tweaked the code so that if you're playing the Bulls and the Pistons in the fourth quarter, the percentages are going to quietly change. You know, the code is going to change so that Scottie Pippen, for example, will start to brick shots more and Isaiah Thomas and Bill Laimbeer, they'll start to make their shots more. And it's all going to teeter totter and it's going to go more in the way of the Pistons. But I mean, that was just what Tremell did. And he snuck that in there and then it came out many years later. And then it's popping up again in the news recently. But what's funny is that that's the really famous instance, but he also did it again in NFL Blitz. So if he plays the Lions, that's the team to play as because he tweaked the Lions' stats. Yeah, so that they're better than the other teams. So I'm not a hardcore NFL Blitz aficionado the way I am NBA Jam, but I would venture to guess that is absolutely real. That's the kind of thing he would do.
All right, I'm moving into a new place and I'm building out a game room and I've decided there are two standard arcade console games that I need to have in my house. It's NBA Jam and NFL Blitz.
Absolutely.
So I'm just plugging away in my iPhone notes. I got to pick the Detroit teams every time. I had no idea that the Lions were also rigged.
Yeah, and that was one of those things I didn't know until later myself. So it was crazy the things I learned throughout this book.
Is there any secret levels in NBA James that people didn't know about that they weren't able to access?
So no secret courts or anything like that. There was what's funny is the Midway team pitched a Mortal Kombat court many years later for NBA Showtime towards the late 90s. And of course the NBA was like, no go. We don't want anything to do with that. But what the Midway team would do is they would always try to like play around with things and, you know, fit different things in the game. Of course, the secret characters were very, very famous. And that started off as a joke. You know, that was where, you know, you can go in, you can put your initials and you can play as a developer's head. Well, what's crazy is that one of the things that didn't make it into the original NBA Jam was Bart Simpson and Godzilla as secret characters.
What?
So yeah, there's footage out there of this too. I can send you this later on. It's pretty cool. So what the Midway developers would do is once they're all done making this game, they're like, okay, we want to put ourselves in this game too, basically as a memento. They don't know how well NBA Jam is going to do. This is going to be something fun. So they went, they go stand in the blue screen, against the blue screen, same kind of way that Ken Griffey Jr. would do. And they had their photograph, their heads photographed from all the different angles. And then somebody grabbed a Bart Simpson toy and brought it on over and put it in front of the camera and, you know, rotated him so you could get all the different angles of Bart's head. And they did the same thing with the Godzilla figure that was lying around just as a joke. And then I think somebody at Midway came to their senses and was like, wow, Fox is not going to be happy, or Toho's not going to be happy with Godzilla. So let's not put that in the game. Let's not get in any kind of trouble, much less to say, you know, the NBA would be like, what? Bart Simpson's in our game and we never approve this? So no secret levels. But, yeah, Bart Simpson and Godzilla were almost in NBA Jam, which is another thing I learned. And I was just like, wow, that's amazing. I would have flipped out if I'd seen Bart Simpson in NBA Jam in 1992 or 93.
It's NBA Jam. It's written by Rayon Ali. Go ahead and follow him on Twitter to find out more about this book and where you can get it. Follow him on Twitter at NBA Jam Book. I was reading the digital copy a little bit, and I saw that there's a really cool, funny story about how the developers went on to produce other games, such as like WrestleMania the arcade game. And there's so many great stories about the wrestlers having so much fun while they were developing this game. What is the lasting legacy of NBA Jam? What has it meant for the careers of the developers, and will we ever see anything like this ever again that is just taking a license and flipping the traditional format on its head to massive success, billions of dollars and quarters?
I think it's possible for another game to do that at some point, but you need the alchemy that Midway had. Midway had all the different perfect elements. You had a team that really cared, that really loved the games. These guys poured their heart and souls into it. It was Chicago in 1992, so it was the right environment. I mean, they were working down the hallway from the guys who made Mortal Kombat. So the guys who made Mortal Kombat would come in and chime in on the game. So it was just really the perfect element of things. I mean, it was late 92. So the Dream Team had just won gold that summer. So for a sports game, that kind of alchemy is something that's very special. I think it's possible someday, but you need to have the right people to do it. But in NBA Jam's case, I really think its lasting legacy is the fact that, you know, it's a great game that it really holds up. You know, sometimes you have nostalgia for something that you played when you were younger, you enjoyed, and you go back and you're like, okay, that wasn't so good. Or, you know, I like it, but I'm done after 5 minutes. But when you go back and play NBA Jam, if you play it for just a few minutes, you'll get into it. Things will start getting heated. You know, you'll start, you know, like, this is what I love is you'll see NBA Jam at barcades now. For me, that's a big part of its legacy, is seeing it as one of the main arcade bar games. And if people are drinking, then the competition is going to increase even more. So it's, you know, I just look at it as it's such a classic game and such an amazing document of an era. It's like a yearbook. You can go through that screen and you can see, okay, here's who was on the Knicks then, here's who was on the Nets then, here's who was on the Bulls then, here's on the Timberwolves then, and so forth. So yeah, to me, it's just an incredible yearbook of the time and just a really fun game. And it just goes to show just how special arcades were. I mean, we live in a different world now, but NBA Jam is the arcade game personified.
Rayon, thank you so much for taking the time out to join us and answering some of our diehard questions about the greatest arcade game, certainly in the sports division of all time, NBA Jam. Once again, NBA Jam is the name of the book. Support NBA Jam Book on Twitter. Find out where you can learn more about this classic game. Thank you so much for taking the time out to join us here on Mystery Crate.
Thanks for having me. That was a lot of fun.